Hey, this is Future Perfect, a radio show and podcast on Triple R, straight out of Melbourne, Australia. Presented by me, Dylan Bird. If this is the first time you've listened, then welcome. And if you're a regular listener, then thanks for coming back. So this year, for the podcast version of the show, I'm going to be sharing some standout long-form interviews that I've done in recent times. And I could not think of a better guest to kick us off in 2026. Yiannis Varoufakis is an economist and former Greek finance minister. He's also a best-selling author of titles including Talking to My Daughter, A Brief History of Capitalism, Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism, and his latest, Raise Your Soul, A Personal History of Resistance. Yiannis was recently in Australia to talk about that book and lots of other things about politics and the world around us. I caught up with him for a long chat in the Triple R studios. We cover his latest book, the US and Israel's attacks on Iran, the Australian government's response, how to beat right-wing populism, the power of the Zionist lobby, the fallout from the Adelaide Writers' Week fiasco, and why he thinks community radio is one of the best weapons for ushering in a better future. And as podcast listeners, you get first dibs on this. This convo is coming to you before it goes out via the airwaves on my radio show, which you can catch from 9 a.m. to midday on Monday mornings Australia time on Triple R FM, digital and online. It's worth mentioning too that this interview was recorded on the 4th of March, and given how quickly things are moving in the world, that might be worth keeping in mind. So without further ado, I give you the one and only Yiannis Varoufakis. So Yiannis, welcome to Triple R. It's so good to have you back here.
It's very good to be here in situ and to see you in three dimensions, not over Zoom.
Well, likewise. It was via Zoom the last time we spoke, talking all about your book, Techno-Feudalism. And in that book, you tell it sort of through the frame of a letter to your father. And in one of your earlier books, Talking to My Daughter, A Brief History of Capitalism, of course, that's framed as a conversation with your daughter. With your latest book, Raise Your Soul, A Personal History of Resistance, you also kind of lean into your personal relationships and particularly the histories of five seminal women in your life. And it's much more of a personal book, I suppose, but there's lots of politics in there as well. Why do you feel it useful or productive even to understand politics and our current times through the lens of these personal relationships?
You know, we live in an era where authoritarianism is on a comeback tour. We have fascism surging back. And the thing about the ultra-right, the racists, the manosphere, the Trumps of the world, the Le Pens in France and so on, is that they tell very powerful stories, very effective stories. Now, I was an economist once upon a time. I spent decades teaching academic economics. And of course, as the 2008 crisis, the GFC was approaching, that was our generation's 1929, I started feeling jittery because I could see what was happening. A new version of the mid-war period of the 20th century was about to hit us, as it did after 2008. And you know, I spent since then almost every waking hour writing about the economy, about austerity, about the way in which the inane handling of the inevitable crisis of capitalism was going to give birth to monsters. And now the monsters are here. And in retrospect, this book is important because this is the only book I've written where I'm not talking about capitalism, I'm not talking about my theory of what we should have been done instead of what we did, and so on and so forth. So this is not about economics, not about so much political economy, it's not about any of that. But it is a series of stories that, I extracted from memory, from my past, from these five women, which I think are really very powerful antidotes to the authoritarianism, the fascism that is coming back, to the male chauvinism that is now rampant with the manosphere. But I have to confess that this was not an intentional book. I didn't think, okay, like all the other books, that I need to write down that this particular thesis, I need to publish this book. What happened to be absolutely honest with you, is that 2 years ago I got depressed. You know, there are moments when even annoying gits like me, who are always too chirpy for the people around me, get depressed. Mm. And when I get depressed, I do two things. Either I play the piano badly, or I write. And I sat down to write, not a book, just to get it out of my system. And I hit upon this story of my first memory of politicization through my mother. I was about 8, 9, and she put me in a taxi, and she took me to the northern leafy suburbs of Athens to visit her brother, who happened to be incarcerated in the Greek Gestapo, the Greek military police, the fascist police, the regime. And that process of getting out of the taxi with my mother and going to the cell and seeing my favorite uncle became something that I really enjoyed writing about. And then before I knew it, I had 20, 30 pages of a story about my mom. And it was too much fun to stop writing. So then I thought, okay, now my mother was, the reason why I'm concentrating with my mom was because she was my political mentor. She was a highly political woman. Mm. She was in local government. She was a feminist and all. And then I thought, okay, well, there's my father too, but I'm not going to write about him because I've already written about him. But I'm going to write about his political mentor, who was his mom, who was a card-carrying member of the Egyptian Feminist Union from 1923, which is, you know, very way that sentence. So I started writing this second chapter, not as a chapter, but also part of my therapy, my self-therapeutic process. And by the time I finished 100 pages, again, it was too much fun to stop. So I moved on to my other godmother, and then I brought it to the present with my wife, after another woman was... who has an Australian connection is chapter four. Anyway, so it's the only book that I never intended to write, which in the end I published and ended up giving me the greatest joy of anything I've ever written.
Amazing. And so these five women hauled you out of your depressive funk, and in the end you couldn't help but be productive and in fact write another book.
There. And, you know, it the title, Raise Your Soul, is what my mom used to say to me every time I was having a low moment, or my father was having a low moment, or anyone was having a low moment. And in the end, this is a delicious irony, by writing this book with a title such as Raise Your Soul, I felt that my soul was raised. And I hope that those who read it find in it something to raise their soul to.
Well, our souls really are in need of raising at the current moment. I mean, you started writing this book. That's right. You know, during a low point in 2024, this is a year when authoritarianism was on the march. Of course, Trump won the US election then. Far-right parties are gaining ascendancy in Europe. Palestinians are being subjugated and killed en masse as part of Israel's genocidal campaign. I mean, fast forward to today, and the picture isn't any rosier. You were on, I think, the last or one of the last flights out of Qatar just before the US and Israel attacked Iran and killed its supreme leader. What's been your response to what's unfolded?
Well, the moment the bombs started falling in Iran, besides feeling desperate about the people who were being bombed, and the audacity of the West continuing to think that, you know, they are spreading democracy and civilization by, you know, bombing kids, as if nothing was learned from Libya, from Afghanistan, from Iraq. Let's not forget Iraq. You can see these people now who are coming out in full support of what Trump is doing. They learned nothing and they forgot nothing. Like, they're like the Bourbons. Learning nothing, forgetting nothing. So, but the political thought that came to my head, besides the, you know, the human, you know, within me screaming blue murder, because that's what's been happening on the ground. The political thought is that, oh, they got him too. They got Trump. Because, you know, the one silver lining about the Trump phenomenon is that he was elected on a peace project.
Mm, ending the forever wars.
Ending the forever war, opposing the neocon idea of regime change. This was the main reason why he got elected in 2016 and re-elected in 2024. And, you know, they got him. Now, you can see J.T. Vance, who is also or was of the same school of thought as him, has been sidelined. That weasel Rubio is essentially a puppet of the military-industrial complex, which in cahoots with Netanyahu, have pulled Trump and his team back into the fold of the neocons. It's a major victory for Netanyahu. Netanyahu has been plotting now for 30 years on how to drag the United States into a war against Iran. The only tiny little silver lining that is left is that he doesn't want to put boots on the ground, unlike George W. Mm. Well, hopefully they're not going to convert him into, you know, another madman in authority that sends troops on the ground. We can see from Venezuela that he has this penchant for going in, doing damage, committing some crime, abducting Maduro, and then getting out and cutting a deal with the regime. Now, I don't think this regime is going to cut a deal with him. I think he's trying, as we speak, he's desperately trying to find somebody in Tehran that will deal with him. But, you know, the Islamic Republic, the Islamic fundamentalists, call them whatever you will. I'm not, by the way, I'm not in, at all in support of the theocracy in Iran. I'm in support of woman life freedom. The comrades who want neither the CIA nor the theocratic regime. But these people, you know, they have, the regime in Iran have a lot of legitimacy amongst the population. Maybe they don't have the majority of the population, but they have a very large minority of the population actively in support. They are very good organizers. They have good scientists. They have good technologists. And they've been planning this resistance to, you know, an American invasion or bombardment for decades. And I think they can last far longer than Donald Trump can continue to be interested in Iran once petrol prices hit a certain threshold of pain in the petrol pumps in the United States. And the blue-collar workers who drive these huge SUVs in order to go to their work, they start screaming against Trump. He's going to stop. He's going to do what the Roman emperors used to do when they sent legions to Germany to fight the gods, and they got their asses kicked by the gods, and they would declare victory and come back to Rome. I think he's going to do that. Mm. But in the meantime, the destabilization that he has affected in the Middle East is going to outlast his interest in the Middle East.
Yeah, and I mean, there are missiles flinging around the whole region as we speak. And I mean, you mentioned how Netanyahu has successfully sort of, I guess, leveraged the Trump administration and essentially bent them to his will in a way, which is pretty remarkable for a nation of some, 9 million people, I think, like relatively small on the world stage. Why is it that that Israel and Netanyahu in particular seems to carry so much sway with Trump and the US government?
Well, two reasons. One is that it doesn't matter how large the population of a country is, if its leadership and particularly its military-industrial complex is absolutely intertwined and in a business kind of osmosis with the American military-industrial complex. The second reason, of course, is the Israeli lobby in the United States. It's not just their capacity to buy senators and members of the House. They don't have that much money. What they do have is an amazing organization where if you vote against them, if you're an American senator, an American member of the House of Reps, and you vote against them, they have the capacity to expose a lot of your wrongdoings. They do a lot of opposition research, and they really hold you by the testicles. Excuse my non-scientific language. but, you know, that has always been the case. But now there's a new wrinkle as well. Allow me to share a conversation I had with somebody that works for Palantir. Palantir is a software company and AI company that essentially invests in war, in surveillance, in spying on people, in all sorts of technologies, big tech-related technologies that are part of the new warfare machine, the new techno-feudal war machine, as I call it, to connect it with my previous book. And he was waxing lyrical about the Gaza campaign, as he called it. And of course, I wanted to jump out of my skin listening to this celebration of the genocide. When I put it to him, you're celebrating the fact that so many people were murdered by the Israeli army. Oh, no, he said this is terrible. But for us, for Palantir, this is fantastic because... And he pointed out to my phone, which was sitting there on the desk, like my phone is sitting there. He said, your phone now is useless to me because it's not moving. When your phone moves, then it produces data that I can use to train my models. So when a very densely populated area like Gaza is bombed, there's a lot of movement. People take their phones and run. So we trained our models on the Gazans, and the result is AI programs that we are now selling to the National Health Service.
Yeah.
That answers your question, but it's an indirect, but I think important answer to your question of the linkages between Israel and big tech.
That's right.
And the military-industrial complex. And don't forget that now, you have Anthropic and OpenAI. They are the new Lockheed Martins. Mm. They're weaponizing everything. So, and the final comment. You will recall that great British journalist who did so much work in the Middle East, Robert Fisk. Mm-hmm. Robert Fisk once said that unless the Palestinians have political rights, unless the Palestinians are freed, the Americans would not be free. And I think that resonates so well and brilliantly today.
And Yannis, you alluded earlier to the ways in which many kind of middle powers around the world have been at best muted in their response to the US and Israel's campaign in Iran. I mean, the comparisons with Iraq are impossible not to make at the moment. And I was looking back at then ALP leader Simon Crean responding to John Howard's government support of the United States, of course, in that mission. And Simon Crean called that war illegal, unnecessary, and unjust. And I mean, today the Australian government wasn't even notified of these attacks on Iran. But I noted that Defence Minister Richard Miles said the government is supporting the US-led action. I mean, that's astonishing for a Labor minister to say that, given how their leader in previous times came out pretty strongly against a war in the Middle East that was illegal.
The mind-numbing cowardice of Anthony Albanese and his government is going to stay as an albatross around the neck of Australia for decades. The complicity to the genocide in Palestine, the manner in which a Labour government that has been given such a thumping mandate by the people of Australia has failed to stand up to a bully who is shredding the very international law that successive Australian governments since 1945 have done so much to erect, to create. This is a legacy that I very, very much fear is going to be detrimental to the image of Australia around the world. Australia used to punch much above its weight in international diplomatic circles, together with countries like Norway and Sweden and others. Australia had... it had what it takes in order to defend basic human rights, basic ethical principles, not always successfully, but consistently. And now it doesn't. Anthony Albanese, together with John Howard, of course, who participated in the violation of international law during the second Iraq war, they've done so much damage to Australians and to Australia. And, you know, I say this, by the way, for the benefit of our audience, I think I have the right to speak like this because I also am a citizen of Australia, so I'm not only a foreigner.
You've got skin in the game.
I'm also a local element.
Recently at Davos, Canadian Prime Minister really said the quiet bit out loud that we're entering a new world order, that middle power countries need to band together in the face of American authoritarianism and bullying on the world stage, where Trump seems so willing to slap tariffs on countries at will. But now, you know, he has also said that Canada supports the US in preventing Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Like, this is the line that the Trump administration has trotted out. And it kind of felt there for a moment that countries like Australia and Canada and others in Europe, you know, could really band together and resist Trump together. There could be an element of solidarity that might give someone like Anthony Albanese the courage to maybe speak up more than he had so far. Yet now we see the Canadian Prime Minister seemingly kind of following the US down this track as well. What do you make of that?
Well, that window of unexpected rationality and decency by Mark Carney closed very quickly, ever so quickly. It was as if he regretted it and went back into the fold of, effectively, they all became now members, unquestioning members of Team Trump. And as you say, they could have done things differently. You know, if Macron, the president of France, Starmer, that weasel that is supposedly the prime minister of Britain, who is even more of a coward than Albanese, but, you know, I mean, it's, there's nothing in between them, really. If those people, you remember those people who, you know, those particular leaders, Macron, Starmer, Albanese, and Carney, they are the ones who spearheaded the ceasefire, the so-called ceasefire in Gaza. You'll recall that those four recognized, at least symbolically, the state of Palestine. They didn't do it because they believed it. They were hypocrites, because if they really cared about bringing about the state of Palestine, the first thing they would have done was to impose sanctions on Israel, not simply to make a declaration. The reason why they did it was because, as here in Australia, they were losing support. They were not courting the right by supporting the Israeli genocide, and they were losing votes to the left. By declaring their recognition of the state of Palestine, they signaled to Trump that Netanyahu was losing the propaganda war. That's why Trump stepped in and imposed the so-called ceasefire, which was another way of continuing and perpetuating the genocide. But it speaks to the point that you made, that those four, Macron, Starmer, Albanese, and Carney, could and did effect a change in the Trump propaganda, in the Trump strategy. They could have done the same thing here. They could have said, not in our name, they could have said that Australia, France, Canada, and the United Kingdom are withdrawing their support to the Five Eyes, for instance, on the basis that Trump is endangering not only the world economy, but also world peace. They could have said something like that. And I think that that would have gone a long way towards pulling Trump back, because Trump may be a madman in authority, but he has a very acute sense of his limits. And they didn't do it. And I think they will burn in hell for this.
The kind of irony here is that a significant part of Anthony Albanese's thumping win is thought to be based on anti-Trump sentiment here in Australia, where Dutton was seen to be sort of trying on a MAGA-style politics, right, and some of the people in the political fray, in the Liberal Party and coalition as well. Yet that criticism of Trump seems so muted now that they are in power. And I'm wondering sort of how this sort of plays on the ground, politically speaking, because seemingly if we believe that Anthony Albanese and the Labor Party won that election in such an incredible majority, partly because we don't want Trump-style politics imported here, then how do you think the public responds to seeing them really not seem up to the challenge of responding to the president and that style of politics and brutality on the world stage as well that we've seen in Gaza and now Iran?
I think what Anthony Albanese has done, just like Keir Starmer in Britain, is he's gifted a great prize to one nation. Because the one thing that draws people to ultra-rightist organizations, parties like One Nation in Australia, like reform in Britain, is authenticity. The idea that, okay, you may not like Pauline Hanson, you may think that she's a brute, you may think she's stupid, you may think this, that, and the other, but she's authentic. You know, she says what believes and what she believes in, and she believes in what she says. Whereas one look at Anthony Albanese, and immediately all you see is the apotheosis of inauthenticity. Somebody who will say whatever he thinks is consistent with his agenda at the moment. And therefore, it really doesn't matter in the end the specifics of policies and so on. At a time when the future doesn't look good, people are drawn to politicians who seem to believe in what they're saying. And that's not Anthony Albanese.
Yeah, there seems to be a real perfect storm brewing at the moment with that lack of authenticity among, leadership, not just in Australia, but in other countries around the world where, citizens can kind of see through that empty rhetoric. There's also rising inequality. I mean, the World Inequality Report recently found that the richest 10% of the global population receive 53% of all income and own 75% of all wealth. In the US, the top 1% own 32% of the nation's wealth. Here in Australia, 14% of people live below the poverty line. So inequality is getting worse in many places around the world. There's also a sense that the system isn't working for us. The Epstein files loom over this large. We're seeing the way that the uber elite, the uber rich kind of fraternize and even in the case of Lord Mandelson in the UK, passing on secretive government information to Epstein for alleged financial advantage. So when all those things come together, it seems that the right is there to just sort of sweep into that fray, sweep into that vacuum that's been created and scoop up votes among people who are disaffected by the system. If the right is winning, how can we take that back from them? How can the left best combat this?
The tragedy of a government like the ALP's here in Australia today is that they are not even picking the low-hanging fruit that they could then redistribute within Australia to lessen the pain of the people that have elected them. Looking at Australia from afar, from Greece where I live, it is astonishing that, you don't tax your fossil fuel industry for huge quantities and extremely lucrative trade in natural gas. I mean, here you have foreign companies that come to this country and extract its wealth and take it out without paying anything. You get more money out of students paying HECS and people paying for beer than you get from natural gas sales. Now, if you're a Labour government, a social democrat, okay, I mean, you're not a Marxist-Leninist, you're not going to storm the Winter Palace, and you're not going to, confiscate the means of production, distribution, and exchange. But at least, tax the fossil fuel industry. You're taxing cigarettes. You're taxing, the local energy market. When you pay for your petrol to put in your car, you pay through the nose. And those people, take all that, mountains of coal, gigantic quantities of natural gas, and, they laugh in your face. Now, how can you possibly win against the right? When the right, what it does is, think of Trump, think of Pauline Hanson, think of Nigel Farage. It looks at you in the eye and says, I feel your pain. They're having you for a mug. They are exploiting you. They're doing this to you. And, Albanese whistles in the wind. And the rightists are offering you a kind of, Faustian bargain. A devil's bargain, a satanic bargain. Mm. I'm going to look after you. If you vote for me, I am going to look after you. I'm going to hurt people that look different to you. And in exchange, you will give me absolute authority. Forget about democracies and trade unions and voice and all that. I will look after you. I'll make you proud again. I'm going to get rid of all the impurities, whether these are trans people or brown people, whatever. And I'm going to start a war against foreigners who come anywhere near our borders or drown migrants. When the Social Democrats have absconded the way Albanese's government has absconded, there's no winning formula against this surge of fascism and misogyny and racism.
Yeah, it's tempting to look around the world for signs of hope in where progressive grassroots campaigns are winning and pushing back. And, you know, sometimes politics of different places are not transferable to contexts like Australia. But, I mean, there's the likes of Zoran Mandani in his win as the mayor of New York. There's also the Green Party over in the UK seeming to be making serious gains. On some polling, they've overtaken Labour in popularity and, of course, won that by-election over there as well. Are there some common threads in some of these campaigns and also other ones that you might have seen around Europe, even you know, amid the right-wing surge there, where there is hope, where there are lessons that we might be able to learn for politics in Australia or elsewhere?
Yes, of course. By the way, full disclosure, I'm close to Zach Polanski, the leader of the Greens in the United Kingdom, so I'm not an unbiased commentator. Together with my friend Jamie Galbraith, we were amongst the sponsors of Mandani 2 years ago, well before you know, anybody had heard of his bid for the mayorship.
Doesn't surprise me. You're ahead of the game there, Giannis.
But you know, those are two excellent examples where carriage pays, and where you know you can have a lefty or a green left socialist, as in the case of Zach Polanski, who calls a spade a spade and says, "Listen, I'm not going to be all things to all people." That's what Mamdani said. You know, I understand that if you are stinking rich, if you're Wall Street, you hate me. But I'm going to look after the people who can't pay their rent. I'm going to provide free buses. And, you know, and I'm going to raise taxes for this. So, yeah, if you earn more than a certain amount, if you don't ever use buses and you wouldn't be seen dead in a bus, you have no reason to vote for me. You have every reason to hate me. But I don't hate you, but I care about the people who need a free bus in order to be able to go to work and make some money and make ends meet. That is the way forward, not the Albanese way, not the Starmer way.
You have recently come from Adelaide, where you were set to speak at Adelaide Writers Week. You ended up speaking at a replacement event of sorts over there called Constellations. How did that all go?
Oh, it was brilliant. The town hall was packed. The crowd was passionate. My fellow speakers were brilliant. And altogether, we gave a bloody nose to that idiotic premier of South Australia who thought himself capable and willing to essentially wreck a fundamental, a profoundly wonderful institution, Adelaide Writers Week, by essentially, on behalf of the Israeli lobby, declaring that a Palestinian author needs to be banned just because she didn't approve of the genocide of Palestinians.
It's remarkable. And to have so many people still coming to Adelaide to speak at that event has been very gratifying. And to me, that was a real example of what happens when enough people say, no, we're not going to stand for this. Like the immediate response from so many authors and speakers who were invited to that event who weren't going to stand for it, even if they didn't necessarily agree with Abdel Fattah, who was taken off that speaker's list as well. They were making a stand. They were saying, no, we're not going to be part of something where writers are going to be silenced, where free speech won't be held up as a fundamental right of all people. Was that a kind of a small win out of that horrific saga?
Oh, it was a huge win. A huge win. Now, any premier in this country and beyond will have to think twice before gratuitously falling prey to the Israeli lobby, to the Zionist lobby. I need to add a wrinkle, which I think is really very important. It is my considered opinion that ban of that particular Palestinian author was not aimed at her. It was aimed at a wonderful, wonderful woman, Louise Adler, the director of the Adelaide Writers Week, who happens to be Jewish. And I think that is what they can't stand. Because you see, let me put it this way, and I think this is very important, especially after Bondi. Mm. If this was 1938, if this was Bondi, the day when the massacre happened, we all have one duty. 1938 was Kristallnacht, the beginning of the pogroms in Berlin against the Jews, the German Jews. We would have only one duty, to defend Jewish life. Today, and over the last how many years, we have one duty, to defend Palestinian life. when you have somebody like Louise Adler, who's half of her family was annihilated in the death camps of the Nazis, when you have people like Iris Heffetz, my comrade in Berlin, with whom we organized a Palestinian conference, a conference on a just peace in the Middle East, and the result was that she was arrested and I was banned from entering Germany. What the Zionists cannot stand is that you have Jews at the forefront of fighting against genocide, as they should be, because the Jews know what genocide means better than anyone. So, see what the Zionist lobby is targeting? They're targeting Jews, because they want to defend the right of Netanyahu to commit genocide and to castigate anyone who's against genocide, especially Jews, as anti-Semites. Mm. So this is what it's all about. That's what the Adelaide event was all about. Defending the right of progressive Jews to oppose genocide that is carried out in their name.
Certainly. And it's the great, I mean, one of the tragedies of Bondi, the tragedy, of course, is the fact that those 15 people died there, were killed there. But is it how so quickly it was weaponized to further divide us? And when you see the people there, such as Ahmed Ahmed, who step in straight away without even thinking to save the lives of people who were being shot at, there was a real kind of common humanity, a shared grief at the fact that so many people could be shot down at the beach at Bondi. Yet that gets so distorted so quickly through algorithms, through digital media, through politicians weaponizing it for political gain. As you sort of travel around the world, you speak to people, how much faith do you have in common humanity versus the people who pull the strings for these big tech platforms and the like?
I have enormous faith in humanity. It's the only thing that keeps me going. Once you get to look people in the eye and to have a conversation with them, everything is possible. But we need to bypass the algorithms, the Elon Musk owned algorithms, or the Oracle owned algorithms, because their job, the job of those algorithms, you know, the way that they have been optimized beyond political agendas, you know, this was my penultimate book on technofeudalism. Mm. What I've been arguing there is that we have a new form of capital which lives inside our tablets, our phones, this algorithmic capital, which extracts gigantic economic rents from capturing our attention and essentially turning us into cloud serfs in a new kind of feudal regime. And these machines extract more rent the more they engage us with the screen. And the machines work out of their own accord. I mean, this is, you know, they're clever algorithms. You can see AI now is developing a life of its own. It's stupid, it's not clever, but it is simulating cleverness. And what the machines have worked out for themselves is that the way to make more money for their owners is to get us angry, to get us really pissed off with one another. So they poison the conversation. So we need to look at one another's eyes and reflect in each other's eyes. And, you know, then human nature can prove itself to be a wonderful thing.
Absolutely. And it's so great to be looking into your eyes here in the studio, Yiannis. Just lastly, I mean, whenever you are in Melbourne, you always find time for us here at Triple R, which we hugely appreciate. I mean, why do you bother talking to a humble community radio broadcaster?
Because you are an excellent weapon against the misanthropy of established corporate media. Community radio is what pamphlets used to be in the 19th century, the very pamphlets that started the labor movement, that started the feminist movement, the suffragettes. Without community radio, we have nothing.
Yiannis Varoufakis, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast edition of Future Perfect, a radio show on Triple R. The show goes to air weekly on Monday mornings Australia time. You can catch up on past episodes, feature interviews, and music selections at rrr.org.au and just search Future Perfect. I'm really keen for this show to have a presence in podcast land as well. So if you could please help out and follow the pod and give it a rating or review in your favourite podcast platform, that would be great. If you want to get in touch, you can hit me up on my Instagram at futureperfectrrr or via the Triple R website. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and I'll catch you next time.